This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Narcissus is a figure in Greek mythology who tragically fell in love with his own reflection. He gave his name to a psychiatric disorder that is still very much with us today. In fact, Joseph Burgo argues that narcissism is on the rise in this country. He says narcissism is on a spectrum from common selfishness to the diagnosable narcissistic personality disorder. He says people at that end of the spectrum can be dangerous. He collected some of his clinical experiences in a book called The Narcissist You Know. Going to be at McIntyre Books in Pittsburgh tomorrow, Quail Ridge Books in Raleigh, and then Flyleaf Books in Chapel Hill all this weekend. You can find out more at our website. But first, let's talk to Joe Burgo on the state of things. Welcome. Good to have you here.
It's an honor. Thank you for having me.
Let's talk about narcissism. As a clinical diagnosis, what is it? What are we talking about, narcissism?
Well, in the DSM, there's a whole list of diagnostic criteria. The two most prominent ones are an inflated sense of self-importance, a grandiose sense of self, if you will, and then a lack of empathy for other people, an inability or unwillingness to empathize.
All right. And so that's the sort of, again, it's diagnosable. I mean, we all have some of that. So how do you, you know, so when does it become a pathology?
I like to think that we're all capable of those qualities under certain conditions. If I'm particularly stressed and absorbed with a project, other people tend to fall off my radar. The world becomes all about me and what I'm doing, and I can temporarily become pretty narcissistic. I think most of us are like that at one time or another. The narcissist, the extreme narcissist, is somebody who has those qualities built into his personality and they're constant and immutable.
How do they get built in? I mean, to what extent does neurobiology play a part in this, and how much of this is learned behavior?
I think that extreme narcissists are made. They're not born. I think they come out of two types of early environment, one where it's very chaotic, a depressed or psychotic mother, gross discord in the parents' abandonment, you know, where things go terribly wrong. Then what's left behind is a sense of defect or shame or unworthiness. And then the narcissist builds this false identity that's meant to deny all that underlying shame. That's one possible environment that leads to it. The other one is a highly competitive, perfectionistic, demanding, harsh, humiliating environment that expects the child to become perfect in some way.
And all of this is kind of a pathological application of basically neurobiological machinery. We create ourselves, right? We create an image of ourselves, you know, and it's some part related to and relying on other people and some part go get it yourself, right? I mean, that's who we are. And you're saying that that when we sort of forget about everybody else and feel like it's all about us, however that came about, that's when we're sick.
Exactly. That's when things go wrong, when there isn't room for other people.
Yeah. How do you distinguish narcissism from vanity, which I think is our common kind of conflation?
These days, everybody seems to use the word narcissist as synonymous with vanity, and it's kind of a multi-purpose put-down to take the air out of people who think a little too highly of themselves. When I think about extreme narcissists, I think about a competitive winners versus losers view of the world. If you're vain, okay, lots of people are vain. And it doesn't mean that other people can't be vain. You know, other people can't feel good about themselves. With extreme narcissists, they have to be the winners and they have to put you down, make you feel like a loser to build themselves up.
And so common vanity may or may not be a symptom. The fact that I may or may not spend or I may spend a lot of time in front of the mirror might or might not be a symptom of narcissism.
I think of it as narcissism with a small n rather than a capital N.
And the mirror that our mythical narcissist was looking at, I mean, I think that's instructive in a way, right? Because if you're looking into a pond and you see a perfect reflection of yourself, first of all, it's not you. It's a constructed vision of you. And all I need to do is throw a pebble into that pond to thoroughly distort and disturb and create a lot of anxiety in the person who's looking at it, right?
Right. It's instructive. And on the other hand, it's also deceptive because it's not really self-love. That's the kind of misconception about narcissism, that they really do love themselves. There's been some studies that show that on some unconscious level, they really do think highly of themselves, but it's very unstable. It's, you know, it's easily challenged, can easily trigger reactions of shame and defensiveness. So I don't think it's real self-love.
Sure, it's the love of that image that they've constructed and how fragile it is when a simple pebble will distort the whole picture.
Sure.
Which is when they become defensive and destructive. The subtitle to your book is Defending Yourself Against Extreme Narcissists. That's really a big part of the project of your book, right?
One of the major themes of the book is that coping with an extreme narcissist is so challenging because of the way they affect your own self-esteem. Because of this winner-loser dynamic that they've got going, they're always trying to build themselves up by making you feel bad. It's very easy to get triggered by it, to become defensive, to want to challenge them and to prove that you are, in fact, not a loser, which only escalates the battle and, you know, you're never going to win that one.
And you say that this plays out obviously and regularly in the public sphere as well. We've got a lot of examples of it on our screens every night.
If winner-loser dynamic and people who build themselves up by calling other people losers sounds familiar, you can find out more about that particular presidential candidate in my book.
Or you can just listen to this exchange between Rand Paul and the aforementioned Donald Trump.
I think really there's a sophomore quality that is entertaining about Mr. Trump. But I am worried. I'm very concerned about him having him in charge of the nuclear weapons, because I think his response, his visceral response to attack people on their appearance, short, tall, fat, ugly. My goodness, that happened in junior high. Are we not way above that? And would we not all be worried to have someone like that in charge of the nuclear arsenal?
Mr. Trump, I never attacked him on his look. And believe me, there's plenty of subject matter right there that I can tell you.
Jake, what do you hear?
However you feel about Rand Paul's politics, I mean, he's absolutely right. I mean, it is kind of sophomoric. But then what you hear is Trump's reaction is immediately to get personal and, you know, to put you down, to call you ugly, stupid, incompetent. That's his M.O., rather than to respond in a rational way.
And whatever your politics, Donald Trump is tracking with a certain, you know, percentage of voters. In other words, how does this work out socially? When is this kind of behavior and under what circumstances? You're saying you're seeing an increase, and I'm wondering if there's something about the world we live in that makes that kind of behavior more acceptable to us these days.
I think that Trump's appeal to voters has a lot to do with a kind of existential insecurity a lot of people feel. They're worried about their economic future, their social standing. So they're afraid that they might be losers in the world, if I can put it that way. And he models a kind of way of coping with those insecurities. You just get indignant and contemptuous and blaming, and that's how you vanquish your self-doubts.
Yeah, and I think, again, in if you buy the context or buy the conceit that it's winner take all, and that's the world you live in, then you buy into the argument and he's your champion, right? I mean, somebody like him. So, I mean, and I think that does get to sort of the cultural support for this kind of thing. You say narcissists are made and not born, and yet you've seen an increase in this. What do you think accounts for that?
I think there's been several trends over the last half century that have led to where we are now, to a culture that supports and encourages narcissism. I think with the waning of the greatest generation and their values of humility, self-sacrifice, and service, and then the rise of the boomers, who really believed in self-fulfillment and authenticity despite their rhetoric about, you know, more communal values. Then we've got a culture that reveres celebrity. You might be familiar with that study, came out about 10 years ago, that showed middle schoolers would rather be the personal assistant to a celebrity than the president of Harvard. I mean, celebrity is now the highest good we can envision. Then comes along social media and gives everybody the method for becoming a celebrity, publicizing themselves to the world. And then you've got this culture where self-promotion is everywhere and encouraged.
Yeah, I mean, you talked about that, the sort of disconnect between, the 60s generation, the ethos that promoted much more social and egalitarian values, much more sharing, right? But they did it through the American way, which is as individuals. So we will wear our hair our own way. We're entitled to a certain amount. They take this American ethos of radical individuality, try to marry it to a compulsion for more empathy, and you end up with a failed project, essentially.
Right.
So and Rand Paul talks about this behavior of Donald Trump and the rest of us as should have had ended in junior high. This is kind of a developmental stage in humans, don't we? Are we more narcissistic as we're emerging and becoming our own personalities?
It's interesting that he mentions middle school, and it's something I talk about in the chapter on bullying narcissists, where, you know, as you emerge from the relative safety of elementary school into the larger world of middle school, everybody's insecure about their status. Everybody's worried that they're going to be popular or not. And the bully comes on stage and builds himself up, builds herself up by finding a victim to persecute, to make into the loser. It's a way of coping with your own sense of unworthiness by offloading it or projecting it onto somebody else so that they have to carry it for you. So it seems like that state, we've gotten stuck at that stage in a lot of ways. And everybody's always worried about, well, am I successful enough? Am I popular enough? Am I falling behind? Am I a loser in the world?
And you talk about narcissism as a form of addiction, or that there will be these kind of addictive practices that you'll associate with narcissism, whether it's bullying, belittling, some kind of substance abuse. You talk about people who can't get sexual abuse, that sort of thing. Teens tend to be associated with narcissism.
They do. And you know, that was actually one of the biggest surprises to me in my research of the book, although it ultimately dovetailed with my experience and my practice, is that the addict really is a kind of a narcissist. When you think about it, the drug provides this high, this feeling of like I'm on top of the world, I'm a winner, and everybody else becomes completely irrelevant and unimportant. So they're very unempathic, self-absorbed, and their drug is the source of their winner feeling that they get.
And the good feeling they get is because this false self they've developed is so vulnerable. It's always under attack. There's always little ripples in the pond of their self-reflection. And because they've come to believe that's them, they're always anxious, and they're often anxious. And this compulsion, the addiction, whatever the substance is, tends to relieve it, at least temporarily.
You know, I of course, there are biological roots to addiction, but you know, when you look at it this way, you can see why the addict is so attached to his drug, because the moment he comes back into contact with reality, his self-image is shattered and he comes into contact with shame, which drives him back into the drug.
But it's interesting, too, again, getting back to the cultural support for all of this, we criminalize the addictions of the poor. So if you're a drug addict, you're going to jail. If you're a money addict, you're going to Wall Street, and you will be rewarded. And you're a CEO of a corporation where empathy is a real liability.
It's true. And we do have this crisis right now in these outrageous salaries that the CEOs are earning these days. And I do think that it's an aspect of narcissism where these CEOs need to have bigger and bigger salaries, and bigger salaries than their colleagues, than other CEOs. And they need to have yachts, and they need to have bigger houses and private planes as a way of demonstrating that they're winners. And it just seems like it just keeps escalating, because once somebody gets a bigger salary, then you have to top them.
Well, and it's fascinating. We read the bios of so many CEOs and investment bankers in the aftermath of 2008, got a little bit of an insight into the personalities. These folks had well more money than they ever could possibly use in several generations, and it was about just getting more money. It was being addicted to gathering and accumulating money.
It's true. Even among wealthy people, you can find those who are very insecure and never feel safe in the world, feel like they've always got to amass more for the feeling of safety it gives them. It is a kind of narcissistic defense, I think.
Is there a treatment? I mean, you talked about how we can defend ourselves if there's a narcissist in our life and what to look for. And maybe we should talk more about that. What do we do if that narcissist is in our life?
The most consistent piece of advice I give in my book is get as far away as possible. It's usually a losing proposition.
Well, in this society, it is. Anyway, go ahead.
I do give other pieces of advice about, you know, how to cope with them if you can't avoid it. And sometimes you can't, because they're in your family. Yeah. They're at work and you can't leave your job. Sometimes they're in your bed. So I think remembering that these people have very fragile egos and that shame is always an issue, you have to kind of be very careful about them. It might sound like cowardly advice, but don't ever do anything that's going to stir up shame. Don't get caught up in the battle for supremacy when they make you feel like a loser. You got to hold on tight to your own sense of self-esteem and self-worth. To do that, it's hard. It's hard not to go to battle. You also have to protect yourself by setting firm limits with them because they feel entitled and they're going to exploit you, knowing that the moment you set limits, they're going to rebel against it.
Can you love their narcissism to death?
No.
Well,
I don't think so.
Now, what about treatment for narcissists themselves? Are there regimes that work? Are there effective treatments?
I think it's like any other psychological problem. The only way you can help somebody is if they recognize that they need help and they ask for it. Extreme narcissists almost never do that. I like to think of them as being like alcoholics, that they have to hit bottom. Their life has to be a complete disaster before they can own up to the fact that they've got a problem. It's rare.
Well, and there can be medical consequences to other forms of addiction that can lay you low. But it seems to me that if you create catastrophes in your life because of your lack of empathy, personal catastrophes, and you're still sort of medically sound, you know, physically strong, it might be even harder to come to terms with that. And of course, you're always blaming those catastrophes on somebody else, right?
Always. And, you know, narcissists, because they have such a strong belief in themselves and are so competitive, are often really successful. You know, even if their relationships are failures, they can be famous athletes, politicians, CEOs. So there's no percentage in admitting you've got a problem there.
Well, getting back to the victims and pointing to your bully example, in a sense, we're all complicit in this. When we watch the bully beat up the smaller kid, we rarely intervene and we basically buy the conceit. He's the big guy. I better stay on his side, right?
Well, who wants to be a target, right? Because you intervene and then you become a victim. And that's what you see that in middle school a lot, that these bullies develop teams of people who join them in persecuting the victim, mostly because they're afraid of being a victim themselves.
So, it's in many ways, it's a pretty successful psychological strategy at some level, at the root level.
Depending on what your goals are, yeah.
Have you ever had success treating a narcissist?
I have. Not a lot, but they are these people whose lives have fallen apart, and they have to ask for help. They're very hard to reach. They're very defensive. They don't take well to, you know, you intervening and trying to tell them something about themselves that they don't already know. They challenge you as a therapist. They feel like being a patient makes them a loser. Mm. So they're very difficult to treat.
And examples of empathy and how it changed their life, perhaps someone empathizing with them or how they felt when they extended themselves to someone else, does that track as an example of can that upend the narcissist?
Slowly. Hmm. I think that the challenge of working with a narcissist in therapy is helping them to bear the shame they feel, and it's a very gradual process.
Joseph Burgo is the author of The Narcissist You Know, Defending Yourself Against Extreme Narcissists in an All About Me Age. Thank you so much for talking with us.
It was a pleasure.
Joe's going to be in at McIntyre Books in Pittsburgh tomorrow, Quail Ridge Books in Raleigh Friday, and Flyleaf Books in Chapel Hill on Sunday. And you can get all that information at our website, stateofthings.org. Just ahead, we're going to talk with former BBC correspondent Laura Pawson about a forgotten massacre in Angola. Please stay tuned.